1993 McGivney Lecture Number 3, Natural Morality and Sexual Behavior. And now, Professor Lejeune.
As I tried to say previously, there is a confession that every scientist should make at the beginning of a talk about human genetics. That is, living matter does not exist. There is nothing like living matter. Matter cannot live at all. Matter cannot reproduce itself, and matter can even not be reproduced. And to make that clear, let's look at a statue. A statue can be reproduced, and between the original and the mold, and then between the mold and the replica, there would be a contiguity of matter, atom to atom. But what will be reproduced is not the matter of the original, because it can be reproduced in plaster, in plastic, in bronze, in anything. Then what will be reproduced is not the matter, but it is a form which was imprinted by the sculptor. And it's exactly similar in biology. What is transmitted from generation to generation is not the matter, because the size of the first body would have been enormous, so that a million billions of bodies could be taken out of it. But nevertheless, the reproduction of a living system is much more complicated than duplicating an inanimate effigy. And reproduction in life is more similar to what is done now with the television camera, in which a tape is modified by minute change of emmentation of the band according to signals which have been transduced from the picture to a special system, so that the band will now contain coded information that nobody can see, but that a special machine could transfer again and transform in your screen on television as another picture. It's roughly that way that the living systems are transmitting their message from one generation to the next generation. When you, for example, go to a honest merchant and buy a mini cassette in which it is written, that is a recording of Die kleine Nachtmusik von Mozart. Now, you know that when you will be home and you put the cartridge inside a tape recorder, what will come to you will be a movement of the air similar to the movement which had been produced by the orchestra. But what comes directly to you is not the movement of the air made by the orchestra, it's even not the score written by Mozart. What comes to you directly is the genius of Mozart. And it's what you like. Now, it's exactly the same with life. Life is encoded in a very complex matter and manner that we have not to describe point by point, but on a very long ribbon that we call the DNA, which is very similar to the tape band we have in a tape recorder. But information is written there according a code, so that you don't see, you cannot read it, but it has to be transferred by a special system, a kind of head of lecture, just like in a magnetoscope, so that now it's transferred not any longer in DNA, but it's transferred to RNA. RNA, it's a kind of negative copy. And RNA is now transferred by another system into a protein, which is the machine tool that the cell is using to manifest life. Now, when we see that, we realize progressively that really life is a kind of symphony. The symphony is written on a ribbon, but you have to have a special magnetophone, tape recorder, so that this can be decoded and you get the music out of the code of the DNA. And the music is life itself. Well, then, when we speak about living matter, we just make a mistake. Matter is not alive, but matter can be animated, and what animates matter, it's exactly the information which is written inside the DNA, and the enormous amount of information which is inside the tape recorder. Because if there are no tape recorder, the DNA means nothing. It has to be read. So that the letter does not give life. Spirit does. The second fact that the geneticist has to make clear is that we have definitely to exclude the Cartesian dualism. There is nothing like a spirit and a body. There is an animated matter. It is the spirit which animates matter, but they cannot be separated, otherwise you kill the living system. And that's true not only for man, it's true for every living system. So we would say, in very simple words, that really what genetics is about is to observe that the Logos is incarnated, that we are incarnation of the spirit. And when we see a baby progressively developing himself inside the womb of her mother, she is an example of a spirit taking flesh progressively. What I would like now to discuss with you this evening is not those fundamentals of life, because tomorrow we will have again to speak about them, but to try to see if with what we know today about life, biology, genetics, to ask us whether this spirit which animates matter has some natural morality, that there is some technique how to use it correctly or not, and where it could be written and how it could be written. Another word, what I would like to try to discuss with you is whether there is human nature being given by the information included in the DNA and in the cell, whether there is some, how do you call it, a user's manual. And whether there is also instructions for maintenance. And you know the user's manual is the Decalogue, and the instructions for maintenance are just the commandments of the church. Are they written, really, in the life? At least, can we find a connection between those instructions and the life. Well, the first we can find is that there is a curious philosophical fact that essence precedes existence. That's totally demonstrable in genetics, because if you remember what I said at the beginning, that the information is in the DNA and must be translated inside the nucleus in RNA, which should be translated now, translated in protein, then at the beginning, before the translation has occurred, if you were wise enough to read what is written on the whole DNA of this very peculiar egg, which 9 months later we will call Peter of Margaret, for example, which is already Peter and already Margaret by its information, if we could read, we would see its essence written in plain letter, but not yet expressed. And during the few divisions, he progressively would express this information so that existence will now follow from the essence. And no matter you twist the words, you will find that the definition of life is just as simple as that: essence precedes existence. I don't know if it is philosophy, because geneticists are not embarrassed by philosophy, because they don't know it. Maybe if they knew, they would have some reluctance to say those blunt statements as I do. Never mind. The things are like that. Then, to summarize, the best epitome of life would be just to read the beginning of the Gospel according to St. John. In the beginning there is a message. This message is in the life, and this message is life. And if this message is a human message, this life is a human life. That's the most experimental consequence of molecular biology of today. And it's very comforting for the science of today that it took us only nearly 2,000 years just to find that at the beginning there was the Logos. Now, I said that everything is written on the first cell, and probably we will come back to that tomorrow. But what I said more precisely was that the human nature was written down there. And you can ask yourself how we know that. What evidence can convince us about that? There is here a great difficulty, because we can measure the amount of information which is inside the DNA. It's very simple. The number of bases which follow each other on this long 1 meter of DNA on a sperm and 1 meter of DNA on an egg, we have 2 meters. That's a whole encyclopedia of life. This length is around 10 to the 11 base. So it's very easy to calculate the amount of information which can contain. But we can hardly calculate the amount of information which is inside the egg. that all the machinery to read the DNA, to transcribe it in RNA, then to transfer RNA into protein. And we know that that machinery contains a number, an enormous number of specific molecules, so that finally, if we were calculating the real amount of information inside one fertilized egg, this amount of information is probably much greater than the amounts you need to describe the whole material universe. But this number cannot be precisely calculated up to the moment. I don't see any reason why it will never be calculated, but for the moment we cannot calculate it precisely. But there is here a difficulty about the theory of information, which is we can measure the length of a message, the amount of bytes you need to transmit it. But we cannot measure its quality. And you will immediately understand what I mean when I tell you that on an egg of a chimpanzee, the length of the DNA is roughly the same as in a human egg. But obviously the DNA of man tells something more than the DNA of chimpanzee. And what it tells is so much more important that man speaks. And chimpanzee does not. Then it means that the quality is something which cannot be measured actually by the theory of information. But to know that there is a human nature, we can get convinced by very simple experiments. It happens that I travel a lot, too much, to be honest. But as far as I can, in many countries, I try to visit two very important places. One is the university or the hospital, and the other is a zoological garden. Both places are very instructive. In universities, I always meet very learned people asking themselves very gravely whether their children, when they are very young, are not some kind of animals. But in the zoo, I have never seen a congress of chimpanzees asking themselves whether their children, when they will be grown up, will not become university professors. That seems to be a very little observation, but it means that something must be written which is different in the two natures, the one of the chimp and the one of the man. And the very learned colleagues who do not see that are, with due respect to their knowledge, thinking like chimpanzees. Now, how could we convince them that the tiny thing, 1 millimeter and millimeter and a half, which contains the whole human nature, is really a member of our kin? To do that, we have to use all the resources of genetics and embryology. I will discuss that tomorrow. But how could we convince them that a little later, when there is not any longer an embryo, but a tiny fetus at 2 months of age, at the moment that it is killed by abortion, how can we convince them that it is really a member of our species? It's difficult to convince men. But an interesting phenomenon is that you can convince easily other bipeds than humans, or because they are convinced by nature itself. Those bipeds I'm thinking of are living on the other part of the earth in Australia. They are as big as we are. They are walking on their hind legs like we do. They have a big tail, and we call them kangaroos. Kangaroos are very interesting animals. Because the female has a very tiny uterus, and she is obliged to have a miscarriage at around 2 months. At the moment, the kangaroo is the size of my thumb. Well, the size a baby is at the moment of ordinary abortion. Now, this little kangaroo, when it is expelled from the extremely tiny uterus, does not look at all like a kangaroo. It looks like a little sausage. The legs are very small, and the hind legs are very tiny, and he has only rudimentary anterior legs with one tiny claw on it. And this little sausage really does not look like a kangaroo. Now, it has an extraordinary property already developed, that it feels gravity. So that mother kangaroo sit down at the moment of the expulsion, and when the baby is out, he climbs in the fur against gravity. And then by necessity he comes to the pouch, fall inside, then he takes a tiny nipple inside the orbicular muscle of his mouth, and he stays there for another 7 months, because a big kangaroo needs 9 months to be developed like we do inside the womb. Now, the miraculous fact is that this tiny little thing is the only living system that mother kangaroo would allow going inside the pouch. She would not allow a mice to do that. Now, we are obliged to believe that nature has, so to speak, wired in the meager brain of mother kangaroo some system which allows her to recognize, if I can say so, the kangarooiness of this little sausage. Now, if nature has taken the trouble to give that extraordinary intelligence built in the small brain of a mother kangaroo, I cannot believe it has not given to the 1.5 liter brain of a normal geneticist, it has not built in the possibility of recognizing then early members of our kin are just tiny human beings. About animals, what is interesting is that they can teach us a lot about human nature. I was talking about the chimpanzees. I like very much chimpanzees, and I have got a very nice experience with them. When I was young, I was interested in the palm prints. And then I wanted to look at the palm prints of the chimpanzee. And I remember that I was entering the cage in the zoo in Paris, and I was having some ink to put on the palm of the chimpanzee, then to put the palm on paper, and then to have the print, and then study it on the lab. And what was just delightful is that after one chimpanzee had got the hand washed, he was looking at the hand. He could not notice what he was interested in. Then he was showing it to another one to see if he had something on the And I decided that really they were a little like human being. I mean, a little like scientists, because they were curious. But suddenly, I had been told by the keeper that if one of them was beginning to do like that and to have some groaning, I should better go out very rapidly out of the cage. It was, there were six of them. Because suddenly, from curious, they become furious. And they get entirely mad, walking around and springing, because no reason. Just they cannot understand the situation. And then you realize that their curiousness and their furor are a little reminding us of our own makeup, but show us that there is a total impossibility for them, and they got excited for nothing because they don't understand it. Now, chimpanzees are nevertheless intelligence like dogs, not much more than dogs. But even the most gifted chimpanzee, the best trained one, will never understand when he mounts his female that 9 months later, eventually, a tiny chimpanzee will come out who looks like him. That he will never conceive. And the curious phenomenon is that man has always known this relationship between copulation and population, between love and child. And it is so true that the pagans, when they wanted to represent the passion of love, they were not representing a coital scene like you can see now on television sometime, but they were just painting or making the figure of a tiny little one. Eros is a baby, Cupidon is a baby, the god of love is a little child. And it was not necessary to show anything else than a child to demonstrate the little god of love. Now, this is extremely interesting because it shows that man has always known this relationship between love and child. And it's what gives to man a very peculiar dignity to his conduct about sexual matter, is that he knows what is eventually the coming out of the sexual intercourse. That's the reason why I think that if we accept, and there are reasons to accept that monogamy is the best fitting system for human population. Well, it can be demonstrated statistically, demographically, and psychologically. If we consider also that marriage, it's a kind of prerogative given to the husband to be the only one allowed to this extraordinary deposit of sexual cells inside this sanctuary which is the feminine body. Then if we just observe those two phenomena, then it comes out that abstinence, if no marriage is engaged, or periodic continence in the happy marriage, are just normal use of our consciousness about what is really the effect of love. Then, without going too much in details, I would state that contraception, which is making love without making the baby. In vitro fertilization, which is making the baby without making love. Abortion, which is unmaking the baby. And pornography and promiscuity, which are unmaking the love, are contrary to human dignity. They are possibly not contrary to animal dignity. But it happens that we know more than the most clever chimpanzee will never know. Now, people will tell you, and it's a great fashion nowadays, that with all those tricks, like IUD, like some pills, any tricks of that kind, we have definitely separated love from procreation. I would say recreation from procreation. And they are very proud of that definition. And they said it's a novelty. It's very interesting for the biologist because it's a regression of roughly 300,000 years. This trick has been already played by nature to separate volupté from reproduction. That happened among ants. Ants are exceedingly interesting animals. They are produced to be sterile. And the only slave of reproduction, the only slave is called the queen. All the others are liberated. They are just walking the whole day. They have no children. But they have the greatest volupté, which is by titillation of the antennas, they are regurgitating a little drop of dew that they are taken from some plant. And the bewildering phenomenon is that the ant, which has got that foraging around, cannot use it herself. There is a special valvules which prevent her to regurgitate for going in her own stomach. But she can regurgitate to go in the stomach of the other. So that, and that was marvelously described by a poet, Maeterlinck. Maeterlinck is a great poet, as you probably know. And he wrote admirably that what was the cement of this society is a continuous exchange by titillation of the antenna and regurgitation of voluptuous prestation between sterile females. And it's interesting really to recognize that because nature is a good teacher, that what is presented today as the top performance of technicality has been used among social insects and has been considered by nature to be good for insects, but not for higher form of life. Maybe we should sometime be listening to the counsel of modern nature. But if we try to be really investigating in depth, can we accept that morality is directly involved on sex? In other words, was a kind of joke which was very popular a few years ago. Well, if there is a morality, if there exists a natural morality, it is very well ill-placed in the depth of panties. That's not a place to put morality. And this joke is just a misunderstanding of neuroanatomy. Yesterday, I was talking about the way our brain tells us things. Now, I said that our bag of skin is represented in the parietal ascendance, and I said that man is like lying on a sofa up there. But if you look at it carefully, the situation is very curious. At the bottom of the ascendant, parietal ascendant, we see the head. But the head is not between the shoulder. It has been, so to speak, cut off, and the mouth is now, the mouth is now on the up. It was a surprise to the anatomist, but it's like that. And man looks as a kind of Saint Denis after decoration. He's handing his own head upside down inside with his fingers. Now, I told about fingers previously. What we are now going to look is the rest of the anatomy. Then you will find the fingers, you remember about Aristoteles, but then you find the thorax, then the abdomen, then the legs, then the knees, and the knees are pending in the fissural space, and at the end of the knees you have the legs, then the toes. And at the tip of the toes you have the representation of the sexual organs, which apparently is cut out from its normal place and is put at the end of the toes. That was a great surprise when it was discovered around 40 years ago by the anatomist. But this is an extremely interesting teaching, because when you look at the end of the parietal ascendant, it finished by encountering another enormous circumvolution, which we call the limbic system. And the limbic system is where all the emotions are controlled and moved. And we called it emotion because it put us in motion. There you have the pulsion for hunger, the pulsion to try to find the nourriture, and you have also the others, which are not for the protection of the person, but which are for the protection of the progeny. That is the search for the partner, that is the sexual drive to have intercourse, and that is this very curious phenomenon which exists even in males, some softening of the behavior when they see beings small, round off, with no asperity, and looking like an early member of their kin. Now, if you remember the anatomy, you will understand why the representation of the sexual organ is so close to the limbic system. It's because we are not four-legged going. We are not crawling on all four. We are erected. But if we were crawling on all four, you will realize that the sexual organ is at the end of the body. So the neurological representation, like the one I was speaking about Aristoteles' mistake, is the right one. But it means that the sexual organs are the only part of our anatomy which is, neurologically speaking, directly in contact with that memory of life that we call the instinct. All the motion, all the pulsion, all what drives us so that we would survive and we have some propensity to transmit life. Then it follows that if we want to control our emotions, our drive of any kind, we are thus made that we cannot control them if we do not control first the sexual one. And morality, as far as sex is concerned, is not an invention of the moralist. It's not a theory of a sociologist. It's the fundamental fact of the way human beings are built, for the very simple reason that we have no tail. In a dog, if you don't cut the tail is where he proves all the emotion. And the tail projects itself on his brain just long after the sexual organ. And he proves the emotion with the movement of the tail, and you can't really understand what means that dog with his tail. Well, curiously, the cat uses the tail also, but contrarily, when he begins to move it, you better know that he is not happy. It's the contrary. What is a cat? Is not a dog. They have a different way of expressing themselves, but they do not have the constitution we have. And for them, sex is not related directly to the emotions. But we are like that. Then I think that it comes to evidence that we have to know that our sexual behavior cannot be independent of our control of the rest of the behavior. It cannot be split of it because of this neurological proximity, because of this very construction of our body model. Now, what we have to consider is that if there is a sexual natural morality, it has to extend also not only to the behavior of the adults, but to their behavior regarding their own progeny, their own children. And it is a very recent phenomenon that some nations who were civilized for a long time have suddenly renegated by a vote what all the master of medicine had sworn for millennia. I will not give an abortion per se to a pregnant woman. 400 years before the birth of the Christ, abortion was refused by Hippocrates, at a time at which it was legal to kill a newborn if you were considering there is one too much in your family. But he founded medicine on that oath. And it's only recently that this oath has been suppressed, and that killing your own flesh, your nearest neighbor, the flesh of your flesh, has become supposedly more than a license, a right, and a progress. It's obvious that in all the species now alive on this earth, there is a built-in system which protects the newborn and which protects the baby against attack, either from the male or from the female. It's very diverse on the whole living kingdom, but nevertheless, there are mechanisms to protect the progeny, otherwise there would be a stop to life. Now, what we have to discuss briefly is whether those mechanisms which were existing still 20 years ago in civilized country whether those mechanisms are a safeguard or a stumbling block. That is, whether it prevents the progress of science respecting babies, or whether it's a real safeguard. I would just look at 3 points. The first would be the point of view of the couple. A married couple are united in one flesh. That's a theological definition. I would say that is the physiological definition. Very clearly demonstrated. Well, then, there was a question whether a technician could be, for a moment, allowed the privilege, entitled the privilege of the husband, that is, to put sex cell inside the body of the woman. And the reason why in Donum Vitae this artificial fecundation or in vitro fertilization, which have a slight difference, because in in vitro fertilization the egg has been removed from the organism of the mother, it has been considered as not legitimate because the man is replaced by the technician. So that there is a substitutio personarum. That is, one person is substituted to another person. On the contrary, when we repair a fallopian tube which is closed by infection, when we graft a new wall, when we suppress an infection which was blocking the process, then we are acting as an adiutorium naturae, a help to nature. And that is a typical function of medicine, no matter how complex this function is, how sophisticated are the means. It's not the technicalities which involve, it's really whether we are replacing one person by another person and then rupturing the marriage bond, or whether we are helping nature and then being exactly the servant of nature. To make you understand that, I would quote a very curious exclamation made by a woman. It was around 10 years ago, and it was one of the first in vitro fertilization in France, and is published in the book of Monsieur Testard. And he said that in one of the first in vitro fertilization, after the embryo had been in the incubator for a few days, it was implanted delicately inside the womb of her own mother. I say her mother because an embryo should be more precious to geneticists than a sheep is to a sailor. And the sailor said about his sheep, she is a good sheep. So we would say about an embryo, she is a nice embryo. Well, nevertheless, it was replaced inside the uterus, and at that moment they had some music to soften the atmosphere. And the gynecologist said to the mother, Madame, vous êtes enceinte. Lady, you are pregnant. Which was the correct description. And then they went out, there were three of them, and they went out, and then the husband came rather anxious, and he asked to his wife how it happened. And she had this extraordinary phrase, I made love with the all three. It is an extraordinary expression that only a woman could invent because it's extremely realist, I should say it's extremely super realist, because how to describe to her husband that three technicians united to put a baby inside her womb without telling him, I've made love with all the three? Well, evidently, they were perfectly correct, those doctors, but she was precisely describing what theoreticians would call substitutio personae. So it's not necessary to be a moralist to understand those things. It's better to be a woman who feels the truth instead of a man who tries to discover it. Now, whether the respect of the embryo is not at some disadvantage with those techniques. Obviously it is. And I understood that very well one day. It was in Hiroshima, near Hiroshima. I was giving a talk to little sisters. There were 12 of them, and they had a big school with 2,000 girls, Japanese girls, but the sister, part of them were coming from France and one of them was French, so that she could translate in Japanese what I was saying. And they had asked me to give them a little briefing about what was fecundation, in vitro fertilization, so that they could explain all those things to their pupils. And I tried to explain it very simply, and I said spontaneously about the sexual organ of the female that it was a kind of secret temple in which the tiny baby was blossoming progressively. And at that moment I was interrupted by the mère supérieure, superior mother, the mother superior, and she said something in Japanese which I could not understand. And then we continued. At the end, the little sister who was doing the translation told me, you know what the mother told me? But I said, no. Well, she asked me whether you really were speaking Japanese. And I said, why she has said that? Well, she said, because I translated what you said about this secret temple. And in Japanese, the uterus is written with two kanji. One is shi and the other is kyu. Uterus is shi-kyu. That's a scientific name. Now, shi means the palace and kyu means the infant. And it is really marvelous that anatomists of Japan, when they tried to describe what was this little masterpiece, so to speak, where the baby would develop, they invented the temple of the child. And probably, when I thought about that, I had the impression that Japanese anatomists were better than we are, because maybe, I would say certainly, the Shikyu, that is the temple inside the woman, is surely a place which is more dignified than a test tube for the beginning of a being which is directly bound to eternity. We should respect the embryos just because they are a member of our species, but some people have proposed that we should consider them as some experimental material. And I remember 12 years ago, it was in England, in the Parliament, I had to testify because they were beginning a campaign to have the right to use human embryos up to the 14th day as experimental material. At that time, they were saying that they would cure cystic fibrosis of pancreas, which is a very bad disease of which baby can die. They would cure muscular dystrophy, trisomy 21, and hemophilia. They took those examples. If they were allowed to play with human embryos less than 14 days. And when I testified in the parliament, the British parliament, I was obliged to tell them that it was not true. Because you cannot study the muscle in an embryo of 14 days, because the muscle will appear after the 18th day. You cannot study the blood, because the blood will happen at the 20th day. And you could not study the brain, because the brain will happen 1 week later. Then they could not make the experiments they were pretending to do on human embryos of less than 14 days. That was very badly received. Next week, the scientific paper Nature published an article, the title of which was marvelous. It was French Influence in Britain. That was really the top scandal, you know. And they proposed a free subscription to Nature to any scientist who would send to them a protocol of an experiment who would show that I was wrong. There is now more than 10 years, and I can tell you nobody receives freely this interesting publication, because they have not published any paper showing that I was wrong, because they were wrong. Now a day, I would say 2 days ago or 3 days ago, there were publications in your country about cloning of embryo. Very curious phenomenon. They are not doing cloning whatsoever. Because cloning means that you get a new individual out of tissues which have not been obtained by sexual reproduction. That's the definition of cloning. Now, what they did is a splitting of embryo, that is artificial twinning, which has nothing to do with cloning. Cloning would be to take one cell of a living individual and to have it grown into a baby. And I will tell you tomorrow, we have the proof that it's not feasible. But they use the word cloning just to make selling the paper. But this artificial twinning is not a breakthrough, because it has been made previously in goats, in sheep, in cattle, and it's not a breakthrough of science. It's a breakdown of common sense, because they use human beings as if they were animals. And that is a big zoological mistake. Now, whether it could be used to improve the efficiency of in vitro fertilization, it's very difficult to tell the future. I have no crystal ball to be sure. But honestly, when you try to split an embryo in two parts so that both of them can regenerate, most of them do not, and they die. So the yield is very little. So saying that they will split the embryos of a poor woman being not able to produce many embryos, but only one in every blue moon, obviously they are not telling that it will be used safely. because this technique has been used in animals. And in cattle, they are not using in husbandry because it costs a lot and it's not efficient. They have used it to know whether it was feasible. And they found that it was feasible, which is not a surprise, because twinning does exist. We know that since long time. But to pretend that it will be used for the good, as far as I can tell, is just pretension. It's not honest reporting of experiments. There is another use of embryos nowadays, which is another curious phenomenon, that is the cannibalism of 2 months embryos by old men. You know that some people, it started in Mexico, some people decided that they could take some cells of the brain of babies of 2 or 3 months of age and include those cells of the brain of the baby inside the brain of people affected by Parkinson's disease, that's agitans paralysis. The result of more than 50 experiments is very poor. There was no cure whatsoever. But there has been article in all the papers, newspapers of the world, because it was presented as a useful system exploiting the good things, which was abortion. Because with abortion, you would get those spare pieces. Now, you have to read, if you have time, what was written about that, and it was extremely curious. Because a man wrote a very learned paper in Lancet, and he said what was the technique to take correctly the brain cell, of the tiny fetus. And he said the best is between 2 months and 4 months. And he said the best for him is 3 months of age for the fetus. And to take the brain when the heart of the fetus is still beating, so that you get good cells in good shape. Now, it's really, when you read that, it's written in great tranquility, very nice English, plain English, and you have the impression of reading a film of horror. And the name of the man who wrote that paper, you would not believe me, but I'm not joking, it's true, his name is Hitchcock. It's unbelievable how sometimes destiny is playing with words and telling us, just look, understand, listen. And we generally don't. There is a pretension that we can do everything with the law, that we can even change the right. And that has led to a very curious and tricky system in England. And if I was Hamlet, I would say there is something rotten in the kingdom of somewhere. Because they have voted finally 2 years ago that law allowing experiments on embryo less than 14 days old. And they have issued a recommendation from a special embryo authority. And it is plainly written, the only thing which is forbidden is to, after manipulation, implant that embryo in a non-human animal. That's written in English, in a non-human animal. Which means, on good logic, that for the writer, they are human animals. Because if he has to specify that there are non-human animals existing, then man is an animal. And that is a very interesting phenomenon. Because if this law of England tells the truth, this law does not exist. Because any law can be enforced in England only after the assent of the king or of the queen. Now, the queen has signed the law, but the law says that there is no human being until the 14th day. So the law applies to the queen as well. And the law was applying to the father and the mother of the queen and all the ancestry of the queen, so that if the law tells the truth, the transmission of the crown of England has been interrupted at each generation by an intermediary animal at least for 14 days. Now, because there is no proviso in the law of England that any animal, whatever the age it has, can inherit even provisionally of the crown of England, then if the law tells the truth, there is no queen of England. Now, if there is no queen of England, that law cannot be enacted. And then that law does not exist. And that's very interesting to see. If just you look at the fact as they are written, that the law cannot do everything. The law cannot negate nature, and it cannot negate itself. And when they have decided that humans were not humans until 14 days, they had, without knowing it, suppressed the whole legitimacy of the Constitution of England. What can we do to that? Because I was speaking about the respect of the embryo, the respect of the couple, we have now to fight for the respect of mankind. I'm a little ashamed to speak about that, because I'm coming from the country of Pasteur, and it is also in France that the first anti-human pesticide has been put on the market, the RU486. And I've read in the newspaper in France that one of the first statements of the actual administration was to force the Food and Drug to accept that deadly product in your country. Now, this is extremely interesting, because this technique of killing babies is now killing one third of the babies aborted in France. That's the official statistics. They are not mine. One third of the abortion is now made in France with their technique. And that technique is curious, because it's made with two products. One is mifepristone, which is an anagram of Mephisto. And this product destroys the mucosa of the uterus, because it's an anti-progesterone. It blocks the site at which the hormone which helps the pregnancy is working. But it's not enough to kill most of the baby. Only 80% of them are killed. So that they use a second one, which is a prostaglandin, which provokes contraction of the uterus. And what they use, it's really a binary ammunition. And it is the law, generally, when you begin the chemical warfare, to use binary ammunition. Generally, it's not on the same shell. The two products are different. It's only at the explosion that they become the toxic. And it's exceedingly remarkable to see that the first product of chemical warfare against non-yet-born human being has been of this binary type. Now, what can we do? How can we persuade people that if we continue to kill our own kin, we are killing our soul? Because the children of a country are the soul of that country. It's very difficult. Because in the newspaper, and I will finish with that, I'm talking too much. In the newspaper I read this extraordinary statement about those embryos, that scientists who routinely clone animal embryos said that cloning human embryos should be just as easy. And I quote, "I see no reason on earth why it could not be done," said Dr. Robert McKinnell. It does not see any reason on earth. Maybe there are reasons on heaven. Because you remember the phrases which said, do not disregard one of those smallest. Because the angels see all the time the face of my Father in the heaven. I know it's very difficult today to speak about human nature, and it is even more difficult to speak about supernatural phenomena. But remember, the people who want to suppress natural virtues like the love for the child, they know that if those virtues are destroyed, no supernatural virtue would survive. Because natural virtue has, so to speak, the ground, the humus, the earth on which the supernatural can blossom. And they are very correct in their deduction that if they refuse to revere the Son of Man, then they have to make the war against the sons of men. Then what to do? If they are Christians, there is still a little hope. We can maybe teach them, very simply, because it had been made by the most known doctors of any time, I mean St. Lucas. You remember that at visitation, the little prophet was quickening in the womb of Elizabeth. Elizabeth was 6 months pregnant. The angel had told that to Mary. And Lucas is a good doctor. He transmitted the information to us. But it does not say a word about the age of the human form of our Savior at the moment that the tiny 6 months old prophet recognized him. He says only that after Annunciation, Maria festinavit. She went to the mount rapidly. And you know, in this country, the trips cannot be very long. Even riding a donkey, or even going barefoot. Then Lucas is implying that human form, the human form of Jesus, was less than a week, maybe a few days. At the moment, an early human being recognized that he was the master carried by Mary. You know that there is a very common subject for paintings, which is delightful, which is Jesus in front of the doctors as a young boy, and this he marvel about what he says. Now, what we need now is that it is the doctors who come in front of Jesus.